I wanted to ask one last. Oh, you want to talk about
that? I was going to say an interesting observation I came across in my research on psychology and religion is the sort of the classic situation where someone perhaps had a difficult childhood and then maybe turning to God to compensate for all that their parents didn't provide. So one would think that therefore the compensatory God would now be this benevolent, loving, kind, nurturing being, you know, that was everything the parents weren't. But the sort of a curious thing that I've seen is that it's not a complete compensation, that often you'll have the turning, which is the compensation, but then the actual image and relationship with God is directly correspondent with the way they experience their parents. So they, when you actually talk to them about how they feel about God and religion, it's punitive, it's scary, it's I have to do it all right because I will be punished. I don't really have a sense of connection or closeness. It doesn't feel like there's love or joy. So sort of just an interesting, all these things, again, sort of assume that somehow because there's been a switch to religion and religion is now going to compensate that the journey is finished. That it sort of needs to be continued working through of exactly what the impulse was in the first place and how you have now transferred onto God the same issues that you've, or feelings you felt in relation to your parents with respect to nurturance and authority. It's an interesting observation.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just one point, which maybe will inspire more questions. I think there, just to throw in a little wrench, I think there is a subversive aspect to therapy. And I say this as a therapist who's very committed to this process, but that I think the therapeutic experience kind of validates a subjective experience of the world. And that, you know, when it's in therapy, one is constantly uncovering layers and layers of meaning and layers of understanding. And in the therapy, in a world of psychology, in the world of therapy, that's all legitimate, even if it's not accurate, but it's legitimate because it's that person's experience. And in the world of when it's building a community, a religious community, there is an aspect of, you know, of subjugating the needs of the individual for the purpose of the community and what's going to perpetuate the community, what's going to create a world that will ultimately benefit the majority. So I think there is a tension, I think, that Orthodox therapists live in. I think that's part of what makes it exciting, is that we're living in a tension, and there is a pull in both directions. I just wanted to put that out.
That seems like a tension that's reflective of modernity in general, right? You have a sort of fundamental tension between autonomy and authority.
Right.
And the truth is that in the secular world, that tension is felt much less acutely because authority is not a concept that's taken so seriously. I mean, the only authority people know are their parents, occasionally their teachers in school, and the government in a very sort of distant kind of way. But mostly they live their lives autonomously, and their values are autonomous. In other words, sociologists have written constantly about sort of lack of community in modernity. It's really the religious community that has this tension most acutely focused. Mm-hmm. It's interesting what you say, this sort of subversive aspect of authority of therapy. I'm just wondering, maybe we'll take this as a last question before we turn to the audience, whether the going to psychology, the going to psychotherapy in and of itself is a kind of implicit threat to religion or attack on religion, right? We're all, I don't want to quote the mission out of context, where the mission talks about the fact that turn it over and turn it over because everything is in it, and obviously a kind of simple-minded reading of the Mishnah is that, you know, you should be able to do everything in Torah, and it'll come out. I mean, most sophisticated poskim will understand that, you know, you can't turn to the Torah for, you know, cardiology or, you know, brain surgery. So clearly, there are limitations to that Mishnah. But I'm wondering, in the field of mental health, whether there can be the temptation to think, like, really, couldn't we solve a person's problems all through Torah? Do they really need to go to a therapist? And isn't the going to therapy almost a kind of admission of defeat on some level? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that ties into your final point. Mm-hmm. And if does anybody want to comment on that?
Well, that's what my young boy was struggling with. I mean, I overcame the resistance of the parents to allow him to come. But once he was in therapy, that was very much his dilemma. And where is the locus of the deficit? Was it in the Torah, or was it within himself? And so he went back and forth in a kind of ambivalent way. But he certainly, there was some guilt over having to search for answers outside of his domain of study.
What did he ultimately come to a feeling about the deficit? Was it in him, or was it in, or neither?
It was both. I mean, he came that it was a little bit of both, which I interpreted as a healthy kind of ambivalence and a tolerance of whole object relations and that kind of a thing.
But I think a studied reading of the Torah and all that is encompassed in the Torah, including important poskim like the Rambam, it's very clear that you have, not only is it allowed, you have an obligation to seek out expert help when you are troubled, ill, unwell, however you want to define it. That is not an anti-Torah idea. Right. It's very much within the keeping of classic Judaic thinking, and it's in the writings. So anybody who's aware and informed of that is not going to have any kind of conflict.
I'm sorry.
In seeking help, again, we get into the whole area of what are you seeking help for? Okay, so if you're seeking help for a serious mental illness, i.e. the young, unfortunate fellow that you treated and the people that I see who have really serious psychiatric problems, I don't think there's any conflict whatsoever that you have an absolute obligation, it's a mitzvah, to seek expert help and get yourself well and do everything you can in that regard. You know, maybe it's a little less clear when people are going for answers to spiritual kinds of questions.
Right.
Or as you describe, life transition. You know, maybe that. But, you know, I don't, that's not the work I do. So it's hard for me to comment on that.
Oh, just in support of what you're saying, that there's this concept of a return of a lost object. And the Midrash extends it to the idea of returning a lost for a person, returning a lost person to themselves, and the Rambam sort of talks about the physical return by, you know, returning a person's physical health, and it can extend that to psychic suffering too. That this is really returning a person to himself. This idea. The other thing which I read, which I thought was a nice thing, was I think it's the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe when he talks about Kibbutz Galuyot, so the ingathering of the exiles. He extends the idea to an internal ingathering, that the different split off and fragmented parts of the self should be ingathered. And he also speaks about it in terms of the imperative to work on your psychological state so that you can become a fully developed person and ultimately connect to God.
One of the best sources of descriptions of mental illness is actually the Chumash. Mm-hmm. There's many descriptions of people in our history who have clear mental illness. And, you know, the Mephoreshim talk about approaches to those kinds of problems. So it's all there. It's not by reading it you're going to solve it. But the description and the fact that this was not kind of a hidden thing is all open and in there if you're aware of the details.
Right. And people that are comfortable in both languages can often use them very creatively. The analyst that trained me was once sitting with a yeshiva boy who had been referred to him, who was enraged at him. He was in the process of a deep negative transference. He was enraged at him, and he was losing control of the rage. And all of a sudden, he really lost when he picked up an ashtray and had it up over his head. "There's not a good thing about you," he said to the analyst. "And I'm going to end this now by killing you." And I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "I looked up him and I said, 'There's not one good thing about me?'" He says, "No, not one. You can't think of a single good thing to say about me?" He says, "Not a single good thing to be said in your defense." He says, "Then you have to let me go, because the mission says in Sanhedrin, Kul Chayav Zakai, if everybody says there's not one good thing, you got to let me go." And the kid puts the ashtray down and says, "You beat me again."
We're going to throw it open to the floor. I think we should give all of these people a big hand.
It's a great story. Right.
We're going to be placing a mic in the middle of the floor, David is going to pass the mic. And I would ask you two things. In all of our question and answer sessions, we ask two things. One of them is to present a question as opposed to a sort of a speech, and to please direct the question, if it's for everyone, then everyone, but if it's for a specific person, to identify who that person is. And I'm going to take a bunch of questions in a row, and then we'll write them down, and then people will answer. So
I'll be very brief and quick. Surprise for Rabbi. I've been listening very carefully, of course, and relating to my experience of over almost 50 years of ordinary rabbinate. One thing yeshiva did not teach me is to not be afraid to go and ask for help. It took me a little while to learn that. But all I can say, I'm not going to make any other comment to say that I fully subscribe to the fact that every rabbi, no matter how big, a gadol, not a gadol, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, should have no hesitation at all to give advice and say, this is a one, it's a problem I can't handle myself. We have two approaches. Either let me think about it and I'll call you tomorrow, because there is a beautiful expression that I've often used to solve problems. Sleep by Mashal Yasa Sechel Yasa Hazman. Sometimes sleeping out overnight and clarifies my own mind. But certainly, I've never had any hesitation calling either individual psychologist, psychiatrist, or often return to JSCS and saying there's an agency in the community can help you. So I say, Amen, and I don't know if I have any colleagues here, but certainly we should not be afraid. And I speak on my behalf and perhaps the rabbi.
Who is next? Who would like to?
No,
okay. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Joseph Barrett. I'm an obstetrician. I've got two questions. The first is, there is it relates to what you were saying earlier about synthesizing the wisdom that's already in our writings. There's such a lot of wisdom written in our texts. For example, I'm thinking of the Tanya, which is such a model of how we can understand the conflicts within ourselves. Is it allowed for an Orthodox psychologist to use those wisdoms that they know in their counseling, and if so, how do they integrate those kind of wisdoms? That's the first question. As something that I've, and I don't know if it's because I'm not a psychologist, but things, and maybe that's bad. Maybe I'm assuming too much. But I sometimes do it, and I have a perception that people find this commonality helpful. That we sometimes speak the same language about, say, dealing with a loss. Because I don't find I can use that as much in someone who I don't know their same spiritual values. So, do you use that same kind of that issue? And then the final point that I guess there's three is over the years I've been in practice, I have had, how can I say, the interference of the rabbis in accessing to what I've said to patients. I'll say to a patient, they need to be induced. Hang on, I've got to ask my rabbi. And now, I'm not going to go and ask one of the great gadolim of Toronto to have humility and listen to me. So what's happened to me is, in a sense, I've had to look at myself, and the humility's come back on me. And what's ended up happening is I've had to look at my own practice and cut down to my bottom line as to what I can accept and what I can't accept. And it's led me to question a lot of the dogma of what I think I've learned as a physician.
Is there a question?
Yeah. In what is the place of listening to the rabbis in analyzing your own dogma and suddenly realize that our own medical training perhaps is a subject to question?
Thank you. Next.
Hi. I'm puzzled by how the Torah advocates certain values of compassion, sensitivity, and we see the great leaders have imperfections too. How some members of the religious community can be so insensitive and so judgmental and intolerant. So you would think that the more learned one is, the more empathetic and sensitive. Can you elaborate on this kind of contradiction?
Thank you. I have a question about self-help books for any members of the panel. I'm wondering whether you think popular self-help books are in contradiction to Judaic principles. And I'll name two very specific authors. For example, Harriet Lerner, who talks a lot about communication between in relationships, Would you say that her principles are, for example, the way she will talk, my perception is, the way she addresses talking to, if you have an issue, is very different from, let's say, if you read a Jewish perspective. And another author would be, for example, Deepak Chopra, who doesn't specifically talk about Buddhism, but talks about very, very practical applications to how to lead one's life. And do you think that's in contradiction to Judaism?
Hi, I have three comments. One's a comment, two our questions. The first one is regarding, it doesn't make a difference if a therapist is a male or female, black or white. I think every patient has their own projections, and sometimes certain patients are recommended to go to male or female. And similarly, I find that sometimes people who have projections towards Orthodox people, let's say growing up religious and having a certain emotion towards religious people, there may be a recommendation for someone to go to someone religious or to go to someone not religious. So I guess it's sort of a question in some way. The second thing I have regarding psychotherapy, when you have a contradiction between religion and psychotherapy. So, for example, homosexuality would be a good one. As a therapist, how do you form your orientation towards that specific problem? There are some therapists who will try to change someone's sexual orientation. Some therapists who believe that it's nature more than nurture, and they will not try to change it. And how do you deal with that? And the last one is something that's more sociological that I've always been curious about is specific behaviors and rituals in Judaism and religion that foster unhealthy behaviors, such as, for example, the segregation of males and females. For example, bulimia, which I have read is more prevalent in Orthodox females. And conversely, behaviors and rituals in Judaism that foster health, that foster therapy. And that's it.
Okay, one more. Because that's a lot of questions already on the table.
I appreciate the points you made about different sore spots in our community, as you mentioned, about anorexia and bulimia and Basiakov students and everything. What would you say would be on the warning label of someone taking a look at the from community and from lifestyle for Chozer B'Tshuva, and also my own self, that I have about 20 nephews and nieces that I'd like to see what should I be worried about for them. So what's on the warning label?
Okay. Let's begin with the first question, which was, can a psychologist use religious writings from spiritual tradition to counsel patients, and if so, in what way? How would that be integrated? Does anybody want to address that?
I have a view on it, if you want to know what it is. It's not a helpful view, because it's a yes or no. You can't have a great and profound wisdom tradition like Judaism and practice it and be aware of it and study it and not integrate it into who you are. I would be worried about me if with all the time I put in thinking and studying the Torah, I walked through the door and left it outside. Okay. If you're asking about introducing those texts into a conversation, that would depend on the nature of the relationship with the person, whether they're interested in those texts, what it would mean to introduce them. I have no problem doing that with somebody who would want me to introduce it, and no interest in introducing those texts specifically with somebody who said, who I know that means nothing to. No different for me than the... But there's no way I can not bring its wisdom through the door. I have to be aware of it. I take it very seriously. For the people that I now spend a lot of time with, those texts are very often on the table because that's where they want them. When I was in private practice and doing it, you know, with all different kinds of people, it was less straightforward. So I think it depends on what the nature of the relationship and who you're talking to is and what that's going to... I like this idea of teach me. If part of what they're teaching you involves a text, you can talk about the text. If that's what they want you to talk about, you can do that. I don't think you even have to be Orthodox to do that. Anybody can engage in that conversation.
I would agree. You have to take, for the most part, the cue from the patient. But even then, there has to be some judicious decision-making, because depending on who is bringing up the topic, it may actually be a way of obscuring some of their issues. And if you kind of go along, and this is a sort of a tacit cue to the therapist that, you know, we've got this common background, so we'll talk about this instead of that, you have to sort of be very careful about when to engage, when not to engage, what the meaning is of the person bringing it up, what is the particular story that they're bringing up, and why is that meaningful to them. So yes, in general, go with the cue of the patient, but be very, very careful about what meaning it has in the for the patient and where they're going emotionally, but particularly religiously.
There's a question here: what's the place in using rabbis to advise therapists on their own dogmas? I guess a way of putting this is, there's somebody that you can go to who you find spiritually helpful in terms of your own therapeutic practice. Does anybody want to address that? Does anybody have such a person?
I think the most important thing, I think one of the dangers, I like the way you articulated it, in terms of this being very much a part of our lives, and it's impossible to step, you know, through that door and say, this doesn't inform my life.
Right.
And I agree with you 100% on that. But I want to echo just a little bit louder the danger of mixing it all together.
Right.
And there's just a lot of very strange permutations and aberrations that exist in the the Orthodox therapeutic community with neo-practitioners, I've said this before, who attempt to do all this and talk in very definitive terms about their therapy. I mean, you can hear an analyst, for instance, a Freudian analyst, trying to reconcile their work with Chazal. You can hear a behaviorist trying to reconcile their work with the Chazal. You can hear a biological psychiatrist trying to reconcile their work with Chazal. And I think when it becomes very dogmatic and axiomatic, that it becomes very, very dangerous. And I unfortunately have seen that. I've seen people who were treated under such conditions by such people who end up very, very sick, and it hasn't been appreciated. So.
Okay. There's a question from the floor. I'm not sure that it's specifically a question for therapists, but that the Torah stresses compassion and sensitivity, and there's obviously a voluminous ethical writings in Judaism, and yet the questioner found that this is contradicted often within the religious community, and asked for an explanation of this contradiction. And as I say, I think this is a more generic question, but since we're here, we can address it.
You can answer it.
I can answer it. I'm off duty tonight.
Listen, one of the in discussing the validity of our faith, and one of the arguments that's mentioned is that you see throughout Chumash, throughout Chazal, that there's not a whitewashing in terms of the Avos, our forefathers, our matriarchs, that there is a very fair vision of people who the great ones who have struggled in their lives. And it's disappointing, admittedly, when you see someone who was very learned, and yet the attributes, the midot, don't necessarily follow. But that is the human condition, and I think it's the struggle of our lives. Okay, is to try to integrate and make our lives meaningful and coherent. I don't see it as a theological problem.
I see it as an enormous theological problem, actually. Because I think that I was.
But you're
off
not
duty.
On the panel. You're not on the panel.
I'm now on duty.
Disregard the following remark.
This is an issue of social psychology. Do you think that there are communities, okay, where you couldn't construct exactly the same thing? People, they go. I was an academic for 10 years. Okay, and I could stand at the same place she stood and said, academics were supposed to be thoughtful, always taking the evidence into account, blah, 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 blah. Then how do I understand that this and this and this and this and this? Okay? There is that tension in all human communities.
But there's
okay? There is no quick fix to turn a person into a saint. It doesn't
happen
like that.
But the questioner was locating a very specific area of complaint.
And we're not talking about sainthood. We're book knowledge does not translate into sensitivity,
that's
empathy,
correct. Right. 100%.
Psychological intuitiveness or awareness. They're not the same thing. things.
Exactly.
You would hope you could find those characteristics in someone who is knowledgeable and, in this case, a halakhic authority. But it's not always the case. And that's not surprising.
I found it equally said in psychology. I studied with people who had a lot of book knowledge and sometimes had the same problem. So I don't see it as unique to religious
communities. But the range of expectation is different, right? I also have spent 20 years in the academy, and I've seen plenty of prejudice in the academy and loathsome behavior. But partly what I recognize is that there's no necessary relationship between intellect and morality. Lord knows the Nazis proved that on a daily basis, right? There is no necessary relationship between morality and being smart. Some of the smartest people in the world, Dafka, the smartest people in the world, are often quite evil, right? What the questioner is actually going for is the fact that there is a specific set of expectations that people bring to religious communities and religious leaders in which the moral domain of religion, the card it holds out in secular society, the sort of rhetoric / propaganda that it constantly propagates as a kind of attack on secularism is that we are better. And if we cannot fulfill that, then there is a serious problem. Of course it's a theological problem. It's a fundamental theological problem.
Ellie, the psychiatrist in me says, what are you getting so excited about? I mean, because, you know, like, what is all this about?
Because I mean, I'm as disappointed as the questioner.
I think Sri and I, we took some, you know, disagreed in several issues. Here, I think we're right together. It's a reality, okay?
It's a passivity.
It's a reality. It's not a reality. These are people. And I will say in defense of our community, okay, that even those who are ritualistic and are not able to integrate the book as you describe them, if they just follow by the numbers and they live this life, imperative in the life is a life that offers a sense of a community, that offers a care. I mean, where do you see, for instance, you know, a woman who gives birth and a whole community kind of come around them? Where do you see when somebody who was ill and the kind of response you get? I mean, there are a lot of things that if you just follow by numbers, even without the emotion, if the mitzvah becomes just a hepzishal mitzvah, it's divorce of any emotionality, but I do it out of functionality. Nevertheless, we have a community that does some very special things.
There's nobody's arguing that. Right. There's no question that there are very special things that take place within religious communities. And I want to say something that you might find surprising, but I don't think this is a specific part of the community problem. I don't think this is a Haredi problem. I think this is a problem in all religious communities. There's insensitivity everywhere. There's emotional obtuseness everywhere. But I return to my original point, which is that I don't think it is impractical or irrational to expect better from those who are in our leadership situations, those who are in our educational situations, to expect better when kids go to school and are, you know, demeaned for their deficiencies,
and
go to shul and listen to, frankly, situations that sermons week after week
Elliot,
that don't address their existential
Elliot,
problems.
Elliot, in the end of the day, hadavar tali bi, at the end of the day, I have my own journey in my life. And I need to be able to deal with the trials and tribulations of my life, okay? I think that we need to look more inwardly than looking at, you know, the inconsistencies that are out there. What is this, our language, what is this projection all about? It pains me, to tell you the truth, that I'm inconsistent. It pains me that I'm not able to live up to these, both with my psychiatric and rabbinic training. Every day, it's a job, and it's my life, and it's what it means to be a human being. We're lucky we have an advantage, both from the psychological community and I think from our rabbinic backgrounds, and that we have principles and guiding concepts and ideas that are able to enhance our lives. We should use them.
These things are not mutually exclusive.
Right,
it's not a contradiction to say that we should hold our leaders and ourselves to a higher standard, or else, you know, as Elliot was saying, that what does religion have over secularism? But at the same time, as therapists, I think the job is, and not just about this issue, but about all issues, as Marshall was alluding to before, is trying to help people get to the point of developmental maturity where they can tolerate ambivalence, where they can tolerate grays, where they can tolerate less than perfection in themselves and other people without getting rid of the standard, but being able to live in that in-between space, because that's just how it is. which isn't, you don't say, well, I give up, and so I don't expect better from my leaders. Continue to expect better. But just like a part of the classic thing that goes on in therapy is not having a bad, good, black and white version of parents, you also can't have a bad, good, black and white version of rabbinic leaders, despite what I said earlier. and to be able to tolerate and then work within that. This is the goal of all therapy on some level is the developmental maturity of tolerating ambivalence.
And all human development, Nassim was saying. I think we all agree on that here.
Yeah, I'd say amen to that 100%. But on the other hand, I want to make sure that we went back to our educational system and we asked how the connection gets made between the stuff that you study and the way that you live your life. And I think we can't expect it to happen automatically. We do need to put energy into connecting them. Whatever that, I mean, and there are plenty of precedents for this in Torah Judaism. And for me, it's not a question of we should expect better in contrast to secular Judaism. The Torah demands this of us. Okay, if we have trouble doing it, and the only way to do it is to turn to more sophisticated emotional devices that allow us to internalize and practice a non-judgmental attitude, then we should turn to those devices because it's a mitzvah to do so, whatever the secular world says.
Hey, I just want to add one thing to that, which is beyond it all, there's a kind of Chul Hashem aspect to all of this that I think is cardinal. There are secular Jews who look to us and look to, and there's a certain unfairness to that, right? But they look to us to see a kind of moral standard that gets upheld. And the truth is that we sell them short if we don't think that the Torah has these sources that can do well by them. A fascinating thing happened in Israel in the last 5 years. A psychologist named Yair Kaspi published a book called Lidrosh Elohim, in which he talked about the fact that he was the secular psychologist. And one Motzei Shabbat, he went to Shiur by the famous Israeli philosopher Yeshaya Leibowitz. And it turned his life around. He began to think very seriously about religion, not in a kind of orthodox way, but in terms of the spiritual sources that the Torah can provide. He wrote this book, and it began to sell in the thousands of copies in Israel. And who was buying it? Secular Jews, right? So it's not such a bifurcated reality, right? That there are things that happen in religious life that can impact on everybody, and that's why the responsibility is so great. We want to move on to the next question. Self-help books, popular self-help books, do they jibe with Judaism? Two books were mentioned. Harriet Lerner, who I guess has put out a series of books, Dance of Anger, I remember, was one of them. And Deepak Chopra, who is not Jewish, who's published just a whole series of books on various aspects of spirituality. I'm wondering, I guess the questioner is asking whether these things are, in some level, congruent with Jewish ideas. I'm not familiar with literature enough to really comment, so I don't know if you are.
You have to give an example.
Some are, some aren't.
That was as brief as the last question was lengthy.
If Lerner's and Chopra's ideas can be articulated in a sentence or two, and then we can comment.
Well, we can come back to that one. Religion and therapy, a contradiction. That's something that we're actually going to talk about tomorrow morning. I know that Rabbi Blanchard is going to talk about that. I know that Dr. Mark is also in some ways going to talk about that, her experience with gay patients. But maybe briefly you can talk about what do you do when the patient's values seem to be in direct contradiction to the religious standards of the Torah?
Since I'm talking about literally tomorrow when the patient says yes and the Torah says no, right. I think I'll wait to give my...
Okay. So that's a teaser for tomorrow, I guess.
I guess, Ellie, if I could comment.
Sure.
Not just when the patient's beliefs go against the Torah, but to return to maybe an earlier question, what do you do when the patient's beliefs contravene your own? And I've shared this with some of my colleagues before, but, when I was a resident at Mount Sinai Hospital here, one of the adult patients who was referred to me for an assessment, one of their first questions to me was, Kornblum, is that a Jewish name? So at that point, I was just getting to know the man, and I didn't know why he was coming, and I said, yes, why do you ask? He said, well, I happen to be a Nazi. Now, why he was coming to Mount Sinai Hospital in the first place, he must have been a Gunther Meshuggah. But he proceeded to articulate his beliefs, and he really was a Nazi, and he really did believe in all the things that philosophy articulates. So at the end of the hour, I decided I could not work with this person.
his beliefs were so offensive to me and stirred up so much emotional countertransference, but also I was fully conscious. I mean, there was nothing unconscious about this. I knew what he was stirring up in me. And I said, you know what, I don't think I can work with you. To my relief, he said, I don't think I can work with you. So we parted ways amicably, and I'm presuming he went off and found some Christian or Nazi therapist, and they walked off happily ever after. So, you know, I think there is a point at which we as therapists have a right to say when the patient's beliefs are so offensive to us or, you know, that we just can't work with them.
Marshall, I had a patient I was working with, an Iranian girl, which has always been an interesting thing when I've worked, you know, the way our unit works is we see people from all out of, you know, through the entire Ontario area. So I think perhaps I'm the first Jew that they've been in contact with. They see the mezuzah on my door, and then, you know, they walk in and they say this. It's very shocking. And I had this Iranian girl who I was seeing in therapy for around 3 years. I was doing psychodynamic psychotherapy with her. And she came the week after 9/11. And she told me that she was very happy about the about what had taken place and agreed with it. And to use our language, my countertransference was that I'm not going to be able to continue to work with you. This is someone who I didn't meet on a ward. You know, this is someone I was working with for 3 years. For 3 years. And she actually, I had a hard time. Actually had to speak to a colleague to work it through, because I really thought that this wasn't an abruption, that it was going to be finished for my own countertransference. But in the end, she actually over weeks came back and apologized for what she had said and explained you know, where she was coming from, which was not really in terms of endorsing what happened. She was you know, quite a complex kid, but I was able eventually to work her through. But it was quite difficult.
Yeah, I know. These questions come up in lots of different areas. For right now, I'm seeing a woman who I'm struggling with my own countertransference with. So she, I initially saw her as part of a couple. She was going out with, she's a 34-year-old physician living on the Upper West Side. And, you know, the fact that she was 34, she really wanted to get married and have children. And she was very accomplished and succeeded in every area of her life. And now this was like the one hurdle that she had yet to overcome. And she had met her boyfriend about a few months before and wanted to marry him and wanted to get the show on the road, get married and have a baby. And he was kind of, you know, dragging his feet a little bit. So P.S., I saw them for couples therapy. They got engaged and then they got married. And within a week or so of the wedding, tragically, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, degenerative Parkinson's. And he's only 37 years old. And, you know, there was a slight tremor before, which she attributed to anxiety, and in fact then turns out to be surprisingly Parkinson's. And I've seen her since then, and she's enraged. She feels like, the example she gives is she feels like she pulled the short straw out of the barrel. And she's now pregnant, but she's now coming to me. She's planning to leave the marriage. Because she feels like she didn't bargain for this. This is not the plan that she set out to. It wasn't part of the plan, and that had she known this, she never would have married him. And she said if she was married to him for 40 years and this happened, that would be one thing. But this is not fair for her to have to endure a long life of taking care of him and being the caregiver and in these kind of circumstances. And my struggle with this is I feel like there's a moral component here that, and I'm feeling like, you know, never for this guy, and the narcissism that obviously is coming up. Whether there's real love for him, whether he was really a narcissistic object that she wanted to get in order to facilitate her own life goals. So that's a struggle, and it's a struggle in my treatment of her. And the way I'm kind of, you know, I can't disclose that, of course, because I'll lose her, because she's so enraged at him at the moment. She feels so victimized. The way I'm trying to handle it is to realize that she's really struggling with her own shock and her own disillusionment now, and hopefully we'll get to it. We'll, as the process moves on, hopefully we'll get to a different place. But these are struggles that I think, you know, existential questions that come up in all aspects of therapy.
The hour is late, and you've hung in there really well. People say that people don't have focus anymore, but you've been here for 2.5 hours, and there's been no commercials, so I'm impressed. Just want to end off with the two last questions, and maybe does religion foster unhealthy behaviors specifically? And it was interesting, the questioner seem to lump a whole bunch of behaviors together, some of which I think religion would see as healthy and some of them which they might not see as healthy. The ones I remember were the separation of men and women, which I don't know necessarily that religion would see that as unhealthy, and certain kinds of obviously more compulsive behaviors, and eating disorders and so on. So I'm wondering if somebody can address the idea of whether religion specifically is actually creating unhealthy behavior.
It's certainly true that the Jewish religion, and if it's practiced in an Orthodox way, even more so, has a lot of ritual and a lot of structure and detail and so on. So if someone is predisposed towards obsessive compulsive disorder, it's not a great mix sometimes. And actually, halachically, there has been a response to that, and people who are suffering from these kinds of difficulties are considered in a different category and are actually either, if not exempt from certain things, there is a modification in terms of what's expected, and the rabbis will respond accordingly. Similarly, again, this is not the only contributing to eating disorders. But if one of the aspects emotionally is about a sense of personal agency and control, so if someone is predisposed to an eating disorder, you know, the religion being as structured as it is, and more as you go more to the right, more and more of the life is controlled. So there's going to be a mix between the predisposition and the religion. But that's not the same thing as saying that religion creates neurosis. It's a very different thing. In fact, I mean, just to swing to the positive side, as a lot of research lately has shown, I mean, there's an article, I think a 95 article by Palutian and Kirkpatrick, and there's another older one, Bergen and Gartner, talking about the very, very positive role that religion has in terms of people's overall well-being, in terms of providing structure, meaning, groundedness, sense of belonging, and so on and so forth. So clearly, religion is not, you know, sort of caricatured anymore in the way that Freud might have had it as kind of being the expression of infantile dependency needs, and really, you know, the healthy, mature individual doesn't require such crutches. The only thing that I would just invoke again is that in order to have that kind of well-being that is described, that there has to be some kind of balance between what I was talking about before, the external practice and the internal spiritual state of spirituality, or else you end up with a kind of religiosity which is, in fact, obsessive and rigid and fear-driven and so on that, you know, we were discussing before.
Yeah, I just want to add that both of these last two questions made reference to eating disorders, and not wanting to keep you up late so that you'll not be able to wake up and hear my talk, I am going to specifically address the causes of eating disorders, and they're complex. Very complex behaviors relate to both genetic, psychological, cultural factors, and whether the Jewish community does, in fact, put its members at greater risk. So that's an advertisement for people to be here at 9:15 tomorrow morning.
Just want to, for people who came late, that we, because Dr. Kaplan has to leave early, we had to switch his session. So he's going to be at 9:15 tomorrow morning, and Dr. Westreich is going to be at 11:30, 11:40. The last question, and one, you know, we've really only, it's funny, we've been here 2.5 hours, but in some ways we've only scratched the surface of a lot of these questions. But the questioner asked something I think is really well taken, about kids in the Frum community. Should there be, quote-unquote, a warning label? And I take that to mean if all of you here on this panel could address or talk about a kind of wish list about, you know, what you see as a potential red flag for kids in the community, either at risk or not so much at risk. What would those red flags be?
I just want to, just if you don't mind, just to echo a point. I'm not going to give away your eating disorder thing because it's not my area. But at one point that I don't think has been appreciated is that there are biological and genetic story to this phenomenon in terms of mental health. We really haven't talked about that a lot tonight, and it is something that I think you're going to address tomorrow. I'm actually going to be talking about it later on as well, that there are certain disorders that are somewhat endogenous to the Orthodox Jewish community. And before, you know, it's a little bit of the split between psychology and psychiatrists, but certain, with regards to more directly to the question, and these are my teachers, by the way. It's a real honor to be with two of my teachers. Rabbi, you can't render a decision in front of your teachers. So, Marshall, really, I think, could tell you about what to look for, maybe in terms of a kid early on, what that's all about.
Well, I just want to share actually a reference that people might be interested in terms of warning signs. It's funny that this question came. It's called The At-Risk Adolescent in the Orthodox Jewish Community: Implications and Interventions for Educators. So it's meant mostly for teachers. Comes out of Yeshiva University, and it's called The Azraeli Papers, and it's put together by Dr. David Pelkovitz. So that's a reference that people may want to refer to.
However, the question still stands.
I may be piggybacking on Leah's point. I'm not sure I fully understood the question either, so if I'm off, forgive me. If I were dealing with a Baal Teshuva who said, what do I look for? What am I worried about? Independent of issues like, you know, things that are where there's heavy genetic predisposition, I'd worry mostly about the eclipse of self, the possibility that the person will lose the ability to discover what's inside them and to use it effectively. I'd worry that their teachers would prefer memory over thought, would prefer submission over critical response, and the loss of an internal self and a guide, that people would be essentially emptied of what their self was like. I would worry about that mostly if I were coming in as a condition that's likely to follow. And I think the incidence of that might be much higher than people are aware.
Thank you very much.